Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. There are times and moments when the repercussions of what happens in the arena of American politics affects the whole Western world. The cultural and philosophical fight over how we practice abortion is one of those issues where, if a domino falls in America, it has the capacity to knock over a series of further dominoes across the globe, but particularly in Europe. There are few people who haven't heard about Roe v. Wade and don't know what it stands for. All the fights over presidential nominations for membership of the Supreme Court that we've witnessed since Trump was first elected were rehearsals for this moment. It was all about Roe v. Wade. So when some unnamed activist leaked the forthcoming judgment that broke the long-expected or long-feared news that the original judgment was being revisited, all political hell broke loose. It just so happens that the progressive supporters of Roe v. Wade and the constitutional rights it's been taken to enshrine at a federal level see the Catholic Church as one of their principal ideological opponents, which is why one of the reactions from the secular left was the threat to invade Catholic churches and disrupt the Catholic Mass. A threat that was carried out. The issue of abortion goes to the heart of a variety of serious ethical considerations, and partly because of the inconclusiveness of the debate across society about just when human life can be proved to have begun, produces a wide spectrum of views, each dependent upon a particular philosophical presupposition. My own experience mirrors that of many people that I've spoken to, who found themselves changing their minds. Philosophers talk about moments of disclosure. A more popular version of this is to talk about the moment the penny drops. I was hosting a live BBC phone-in programme on faith and ethics when a woman phoned in who took an energetically opposed position against abortion. That was when my penny dropped. Whilst I gave her space to air her views before, as the BBC always does, putting the opposite views into the conversation for the sake of so-called balance, I googled some facts. I wanted to know what the scale was that we were talking about. I discovered that since the 1967 Abortion Act in the UK, there have been 6 million terminations. I was astonished and alarmed, and I said so out loud, and it was live radio. 6 million, I said. That's a problematic number. That's a Holocaust. The next day, I was summoned to the station director's office, and I was told that if ever I made that connection on the radio again, the plug would be pulled and I'd be summarily fired. And that marked the beginning of my own further exploration, which ended in my belief that the only position that could be taken with intellectual and moral probity was the Catholic position. Looking for a Catholic voice who could bring a depth of expertise and understanding of the American political and philosophical and Catholic world brought us to the door of Richard Dorflinger. Until 2016, for 36 years, Richard prepared testimony and other materials on abortion, euthanasia, human clothing, stem cell research, and other issues for the U.S. Conference of Catholics Bishops Secretariat of Pro-Life Activities. He's a widely published author, and amongst other positions that he holds is a fellow at the University of Notre Dame's De Nicola Center for Ethics and Culture, as well as being an adjunct fellow in bioethics and public policy at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. And he joins me now. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them how you got into it in the first place before we look at the specifics of the situation we're about to look at?
Well, I came into pro-life work in 1980. I had done doctoral work in theology at the Catholic University of America and completed those requirements for a doctorate except for the dissertation. Never quite finished that, but started working for the Catholic Bishops' Conference in 1980 in the pro-life activities office, eventually became associate director of that office. So worked for 36 years on public policy. I was around for many of the, not for Roe v. Wade itself, but for many of the Supreme Court decisions since. Worked with our attorneys on some of our briefs in those cases. Was very involved in trying to pass legislation that the pro-life movement wanted to see. And now I'm retired as of 6 years ago, but I still seem to keep busy with writing and speaking on these issues.
So Planned Parenthood against Casey introduced a new development in terms of removing some of the time limitations for women to seek an end to their pregnancies. And now we have this bombshell from Justice Alito. The people I've been listening to say there's been campaigning on the ground trying to prepare the Supreme Court for a move exactly like this. Has there been a long-term political campaign from both sides so that when the moment came that there was a conservative majority, this issue could be addressed?
Oh, yes. It's unfortunately, it's really sort of distorted the whole process for confirming Supreme Court justices, because this is one of the issues that people on both sides of the issue want to ask about. And their question is always, basically, are you going to rule my way on this? And no justice in his or her right mind answers that question directly, because if you answered it now, it would mean that you're not paying attention to the arguments and briefs in the case. You're making a deal with a politician about how you're going to rule in a future case. But dissent from Roe versus Wade, the 1973 case, began with the decision itself. It has always been there. Not only legal experts who would support legalization of abortion in various circumstances said, you know, I would support this policy, but there's nothing about this in the Constitution. The court was dividing up pregnancy into three-month segments with different rules for each and talking about a fundamental right, and it's simply not there. There were two dissenters from the original ruling, Justices White and Rehnquist. Justice White was a Democratic nominee. He was nominated to the court by John Kennedy. And he said, this is an act of raw judicial power. It has no basis in the Constitution. Those arguments have been around for the last 50 years. What's new now is that you finally have five justices on the court, it seems, because this is only a draft opinion that's been leaked. You have five justices who agree with it and are willing to act on it.
So one of the things that you're saying, which not everyone, at least in England, may have grasped, is that the attempt to derive from the American Constitution itself a platform that provided either the rights of liberty or privacy to be enacted in the act of abortion was philosophically and jurisprudentially illegitimate. The phrase I thought was most powerful was it was conjured up out of thin air. It was simply a determination of that particular group of justices to come to that decision. Come what may, they invented a specious line of jurisprudential reading to justify it. That's now been revisited, and people are saying it was invented, it's not coherent, and just on the grounds of being legally consistent, we need to revisit it.
That's about right. And, you know, the fact that it's been around a long time doesn't mean that it gets any better. One of our big reversals of a Supreme Court decision was our Brown versus Board of Education decision about it was knocking down a decision from 54 years before that said Black Americans and white Americans could be in separate schools and it would be separate but equal. The court eventually realized, and it was proved to its satisfaction, that separate is not equal, that this was a way to give Black Americans a substandard education. But that took many, many years, and there were protests and there were riots about that, especially in the southern states. But everybody sees the Brown versus Board now as one of the great decisions of the court. Whether that's true here remains to be seen. The arguments that are in the leaked draft opinion are not new, and they're not hard to understand. The court's claim in Roe versus Wade that there's a right to abortion protected by the 14th Amendment ignores, among other things, the fact that the states that ratified the 14th Amendment all at the same time were passing stronger laws than ever against abortion. Mm-hmm. Nobody who ratified the 14th Amendment thought that it had anything to say in favor of abortion.
Before we get to some of the more practical consequences about what's going to happen, can we just slip into the field of conspiracy theory for a moment? So, who in your opinion leaked this, the left or the right? Do we see the greatest advantage accruing to a Republican who wants to shore up anxious justices as they digest the implications of Justice Alito's paper, or do we see it as favoring the progressives who want to shock America as the midterm elections come into turning out and demanding a huge Democratic riposte to the legitimacy of the Supreme Court? I mean, that in itself is such an incredible question to ask. Why would any political branch of a democracy seek to undermine the legitimacy of a Supreme Court to reach jurisprudential decisions?
My view is that it's more likely that it was leaked by someone who was against the opinion to start whipping up the opposition and maybe convince one or more of these justices to hold back and change his or her mind. And I don't know whether that's likely to happen. The justices in the past have been very annoyed at people trying to pressure them into decisions when they think it's legally right to make a decision the way they have. I do think it has led to some premature outrage. We don't know if this is the final decision or anything like it, but it's also something that I think is designed to say, if not the Supreme Court itself, then this particular set of justices on the Supreme Court lack legitimacy. What the justices are saying is, look, because the Constitution does not dictate one policy on this, you, the people of the United States, women and men, are free to make your own decisions about these policies. I thought it was interesting that Justice Alito mentioned in Mississippi, the state that passed the abortion law that was before the court, the ban on abortions after 15 weeks of gestation. Women are 51% of the population there, but 55% of the voting population. And so this is not taking anything from women. What it's doing is saying the women who have a moral concern about abortion now have the same rights that women who don't have that concern had for the last 50 years. Is giving us a level playing field where people can debate these complicated issues and try to reach an accommodation with each other.
So in one sense, in democratic terms, this is a complete no-brainer, isn't it? You have the federal dimension the Supreme Court brings, but all that's going to happen is that the Supreme Court is delegating to each state and the democratic voters in each state the right to decide their own local practices. If this goes through, is that a right reading of the consequences, or are they more complex than that? Are there other dominoes that will fall?
It is pretty much that simple legally. States like my own state of Washington, which has a very expansive abortion law that goes beyond Roe versus Wade. You can't even buy a health insurance policy in Washington state that doesn't include full coverage for abortion, even if you wanted to. So those states are free to continue to have those policies. There are about half of the states here, half of the 50 states that are probably going to place some restrictions on abortion. And there are states that are saying they're proud to announce that they're going to be abortion havens for any woman who wants to come into the state to have an abortion and for abortion practitioners to move there. It's a messy situation in that sense. It's the same situation we had before Roe versus Wade. States took different decisions. We did have our federal government, the Congress, recently have a vote on a federal bill that nationwide would have established a pro-abortion policy that, again, is more extreme than Roe versus Wade, would have said up until birth, you must allow abortion, you must knock down any law that in any way places a limit on access to abortion. And that would knock down a lot of modest state laws on parents' rights when a minor seeks abortion, bans on public funding of abortion, and so on, that have existed under Roe versus Wade. But that federal bill failed. It does look as though we are going to be having a renewal of democratic debate on this issue. And I think overall that's healthy, but it also means we're going to have to find a way to do that in a civil manner, and that is not immediately apparent yet.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, without wanting to make false historical comparisons, the issue of slavery ignited a wider conflict that ultimately led to a civil war. Some people are saying that in the division of red and blue states, and with all the excitement that Donald Trump brought to the political chemistry of the states, the whole situation is ratcheting up to produce conflict rather than the kind of civility you're talking about. Are political commentators looking beyond the issue of abortion with a sense of alarm about what this means for democratic conversation in the states?
Our politics has become very polarized, with people pretty far on the liberal and conservative spectrum in both parties. Donald Trump did not create that, but he may have helped to aggravate it. And this has always been one of the most divisive issues. People have called abortion the third rail of American politics. That's the one you don't touch if you don't want to die. So it's an especially divisive thing. And one of the things that the court said in Planned Parenthood versus Casey that I always try to keep in mind in explaining to myself why some people are so outraged at this is that the reason they were not going to reverse Roe v. Wade, or a reason, was that, well, you have all these people who have shaped their intimate relationships and their plans for their lives based on the availability of abortion if contraception fails. So now, after 50 years of people assuming that, all of a sudden that's up for grabs in the sense that your own state may pass something that doesn't make abortion so available. I think there's a lot of fear. All these plans I made for my life, are they going to be knocked down? I don't think that's true, but I think a lot of people fear that it's true. And I think that places an extra obligation on those of us who are pro-life to make sure that we increase our support for pregnant women and for women in bad circumstances, women in poverty who may feel pressured toward abortion, who may think that's their only solution if they want to advance in their lives, and show that we are going to make that a needless concern. That's the other half of the equation. How are we going to make sure women who become unexpectedly pregnant are going to receive full support from society? That's not something that has become a very positive conversation yet between people on the two sides. Though I will say that my former employer, the Catholic Bishops Conference, a year ago started a program called Walking with Moms in Need, in which they were telling all the 180 or so dioceses throughout the United States, please look at your support locally for pregnancy aid centers and for support for women and increase those efforts, increase the resources given to that. Just in case the court were to overrule Roe v. Wade, we would want to be ready to make sure women have a place to go so they don't see abortion as their only choice.
That's very moving and very important. I'd like to come back to the Catholic Church's role in a moment, but before I do, so it's a very good thing indeed that those states and those agencies that are against abortion are providing, as you quite rightly say, humanitarian and humane support for people in trouble. But presumably the Democrats' fury, or the pro-choice fury that will lead to their states being havens of abortion, in a way that undermines part of the universal scare tactics, doesn't it? If they're saying, well, you're going to have a whole series of blue states where you can get abortion easily and we'll help you with travel and we'll help you with facilities. And it's not that far from any red state to any blue state, obviously some further than others. But shouldn't that take out some of the panic? The choice will remain, opportunity will remain. Clearly, some people are going to be poorer than others, but there'll be benevolent agencies and politicized agencies, both of which are likely to seek to help people who want to make that choice. Is that right?
To some extent, I think it is. I mean, it is a big country, and some people will find it harder to travel than other people. But it is not the case that you have to leave the country, or even generally your part of the country, to get an abortion if that's what you really want. I mean, I think the rank and file people that are in these protests, some of which have turned rather violent, frankly. Offices of pro-life organizations have been attacked. There were some Molotov cocktails thrown at a couple of them. Some Catholic churches have been vandalized. And I think that the rank and file people really are just afraid of this change in what they assumed was the way their lives would work. I do think that on the part of the major groups, the pro-abortion groups in the society, they knew this was coming. They knew that you now had five justices who were unlikely to uphold the Roe versus Wade decision. And so I think a lot of the outrage is orchestrated by them. They want to create a backlash against any pro-life legislation, against the pro-life movement. And it remains to be seen, but it may backfire because they are showing themselves in many cases to be as unwilling to talk without yelling that they've generally attributed to pro-life people.
Right.
What we have to do, especially Catholics, is to show that we care about women more than some people on the other side do, that we care about children and women. This is the hard part. And we even love our enemies, as our founder said we have to, and that we respect them even if they don't respect us. The Catholic Church and other Christians have to be in the lead on that part of this, that we have to say, look, we are concerned about the life of this child. We are also concerned about your life. We should try to talk about what common ground we can find.
And presumably, although a lot of conservative ethicists might like it, there is no link here in terms of changing any cultural legal practice or access to other ethical areas of society. So marriage, contraception, gay rights, such as they are. This isn't the beginning of a right-wing avalanche that threatens progressive rights. It's a single issue, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one of the made-up arguments. Justice Alito's draft opinion was very, very clear in saying, look, yes, we know we've talked about liberties and privacy rights in these other areas, marriage, sexuality, and so on. But this is different. This is different from all of those because there's another party involved. Even Roe v. Wade said there's another party involved. and that deserves some attention. But then when they actually laid out their specific policies, they didn't pay very much attention to that. Even in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the court said, if we made a mistake in Roe versus Wade, it was not on the part of the interests of the woman. It may have been on the part of the interests of the child in surviving. But then they passed over that and said, but it's been around so long, we need to uphold it. In fact, when Justice Alito, he has this very long footnote where he cites, here are the cases where the court has overturned itself and decided it had been wrong. Among the cases he cited that overturned past decisions were, for example, the decision saying there's a right to same-sex marriage. So you couldn't find a better example of how he is not saying this is the start for an assault on these other things. This is different. It is a unique situation in which the interests of the mother and child may seem to be in conflict, but also are inextricably linked with each other.
And it leaves the Catholic Church in a very interesting position, doesn't it? It's been rather frightening on the social media to see pretty voluble, potentially violent and aggressive demonstrations outside Catholic churches as if it had been the Catholic Church in some conspiratorial way that was behind the Supreme Court's decision, which, you know, no one in their right mind could ever see or imagine. But I like very much the description you've given us of the Catholic Bishops' Conference saying this is an opportunity for us to be at the front of the queue when it comes to showing compassion, understanding, and practical help for people in trouble. So how do you see the Catholic Church coming out of this, since inevitably, whether it wants it or not, it's seen as a major player and a major causative factor philosophically? Is it going to damage the Catholic Church, make it the kind of fall guy for one of the most powerful pieces of legislative innovation for a very long time? Or is it going to propel it to the center of her public attention with an opportunity to practice and convince people of its virtue?
Well, I think it is an opportunity, but I think the Catholic Church was one of the institutions that kept this issue alive for so long after Roe versus Wade. Initially, we had very little company in saying that decision must be reversed, but the pro-life movement now is very diverse and very broad, and people of different denominations, of no denomination at all. There are progressive pro-life organizations. There's a Feminists for Life organization. And all of those are going to be part of this. There, as an example, recently the state of Louisiana was considering a bill to say that an abortion is a species of homicide and that criminal penalties could even be brought against the woman involved. 70 pro-life organizations, including the Catholic Bishops Conference, said, this is not right. We have never said the woman should be punished. The woman is often acting under duress. She's going to have her own possible physical and also emotional problems from the abortion. We want to shut down the abortion industry. The abortionist could go on and perform hundreds of more abortions and not go after the woman. That coalition formed in very, very short time when this bill was seen. And Louisiana changed its bill to say there'll be no penalties against the woman, which has been the position of the whole pro-life movement nationally for many years. So I think the Catholic Church should be part of those movements. It can also emphasize to the other groups this need for compassionate care for the woman. And as to the church's moral authority, well, I would hope that what it is saying about a culture of life that respects everyone and defends everyone's life from conception to natural death has another opportunity to gain wider support. It is one of the reasons I started working for the Catholic Church was that when I saw its teaching on this, I thought, well, that's the only consistent position, isn't it? That all of us, the weakest and the strongest, at every stage of development, have a right to live and a right to the respect of others simply because we are human beings made in the image and likeness of God. Not a bad position to take. It applies to a lot of different issues across the spectrum. This is another opportunity to try to explain to Catholics and others why that is the position that leads us to a society where people do fully respect each other.
I can understand, I think anyone can understand, how it is that Christians move from a position of not caring or not knowing, or in my case, a few decades ago, really not even seeing the implications of abortion. But What are some of the factors that have led to secularists coming on board as pro-lifers? That you say there's a diverse coalition of philosophical and political interests. There's been some exposure of the awful scandal, the sale of baby parts, which must have revolted anyone, whatever their metaphysical allegiances. Is that one of the elements? What are some of the catalysts that have moved people from either not caring, not seeing, or taking the hardline feminist approach to a more acute sense of the ethical sensitivities?
I think there are a number of things. I think people who were involved in progressive issues like opposing capital punishment, like trying to end violence as a solution to problems in society, eventually said, well, you know, this is a form of violence too. It's hard to dismiss that reality when you see even the most clinical description of what an abortion does to the unborn child. I think that some women who used to work for the abortion industry, who used to work for Planned Parenthood, for example, became disgusted at some of the practices there and things they saw about abortion and ended up joining the pro-life movement. And I think that just the modern medical advances in sonograms, in a more complete understanding of the beginnings of human development, have led some people who are very much interested in the science of all this to say, well, yes, this is the beginning of a human life. It would be arbitrary to say that this is not part of the spectrum of human life that deserves respect and protection. One of my favorite organizations, in a way, is Feminists for Life, because they went back and looked at the early feminists, the suffragettes and so on, who were fighting for women to have the vote, and found that just about all of them were pro-life. They were horrified by abortion. They said it's something that men support in order to get off of their responsibilities and place this terrible thing on the woman. Feminists for Life has gone especially around to colleges and said, how can colleges and universities improve their ways of allowing women who are pregnant to have their child and still continue their education and graduate with the help of the institution around them? So it is diverse, and I think that's enormously healthy, that you have people coming from different perspectives and from different philosophies and religions who all agree this deserves addressing. This child is another party in the equation that deserves respect. In fact, the woman may be the second most helpless person in that situation, but the child is the only one who is even more helpless. And let's see if there's ways we can help them both.
I know we agreed that there weren't going to be obvious falling dominoes that would be toppled by this decision if it goes through. But of course, it does occur to me at least that assisted suicide or euthanasia is a related ethical topic. If this is based on the sanctity of life and protection of the vulnerable, then once you begin to change the culture at the beginning of life, it must have some effect in terms of persuading people logically it may apply to the end of life as well. In Europe, we're finding a real threat to our ethics in terms of the sanctity of human life from assisted suicide or the practice of euthanasia. Is that happening in the States too? And what do you see this decision, if it goes through, as doing to that?
Well, the Supreme Court already has had a 9-0 decision on assisted suicide saying it's not a constitutional right. So at least that is off the table. But we have 10 states and the District of Columbia that have legalized it. And they legalized it by arguing to the voters and the legislators that this is going to be hedged about by all kinds of safeguards against expansion and abuse and coercion and so on. What we're seeing now in those states is efforts to say, you know, those safeguards are really barriers to access, which is the great slogan on abortion, too, that we want access. And so here in Washington state, we just had a vote that defeated an expansion bill to say you shouldn't require a doctor. The lethal prescriptions should be given by a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner and so on, that we don't need a waiting period. You know, somebody says, I want to die, you get the prescription, and so on. What they once called safeguards, they're now trying to throw aside. And we're pointing that out to the legislators. And even in Washington state, which is a very liberal state, so far we've managed to convince the legislature not to go that way. But it certainly gives credence to the slippery slope concerns that have come to fruition in an even more expansive way in Europe. You know, slippery slope is not just something that says, well, once you approve X, people will do Y. It means that you've initially made this one decision that once you look at any limit on it, those limits are less substantial than the fundamental decision you've already made. And the fundamental decision here is that for some people, because they are ill in various ways, for example, what we abhor for everyone else, suicide, is a good thing. Not because it's a free choice, because we routinely stop that free choice when other people want to commit suicide. It's because their lives don't have the meaning that other people's lives have. When you realize it's really about that, it is very much like the abortion issue. People have talked about the right to assisted suicide, but you have to realize that the patient in this case is not in the position of the pregnant woman in abortion. That person is in the position of the despised fetus, that other people are eager to help end their lives because they just don't think that certain lives are going to be long enough or happy enough to have the same legal protections as other people's lives. And that is what always has inspired me to work on that issue. In recent years, I've probably worked more on the assisted suicide issue than on abortion. Jokingly, I tell my friends it's one of the issues that men are still allowed to talk about. But it is an issue that already is going state by state. But there have been a lot more bills to legalize it defeated in the various states than to allow it. And it is still very much a political issue. And it's an issue where it's not as fully polarized between the two political parties as abortion has become. You can still talk to a fellow Democrat about the harms of this.
I was astonished when I discovered that the restricted categories for abortion, for which it was understandably demanded, rape, incest, and unusual and extreme abuses of women leading to pregnancy, that in practice those form a category of only 1% of all abortions. So this single category that was laid down as being the essential template for protection, with the assumption it wouldn't expand much beyond that, it in fact did. It moved from 1% to 99% beyond that. And once again, it's an example that promises made to the electorate that legislation will be kept within the ethical boundaries that initially allowed them to sell it are not reliable.
That's true. And the great majority of the states at the time that Roe v. Wade was handed down had kept their older laws that in most cases only had a life of the mother exception. And some had expanded to allow an exception for rape or incest and a couple of other things. Only 4 states allowed abortion for any reason, and even those had a time limit on when an abortion is legal that is narrower than what the Supreme Court ended up doing. So in other words, the Roe v. Wade decision knocked down all 50 state laws. And we know that these cases, these hard cases, are a tiny percentage of the abortions. And frankly, a lot of public opinion polls have shown that those are the cases that most Americans would support as a basis for making a compromise law. But it has become a campaign for, as one of the slogans used says, abortion on demand and without apology. And from being seen as a necessary evil or a difficult last resort, we now have campaigns that say, celebrate your abortion. Abortions simply because this is going to serve your plans for your life, essentially. Most Americans are not in favor of such a broad license for abortion, particularly in the later stages of pregnancy. That's the other thing that is a fruitful area for talking about. There was a federal bill before Congress got taken over by Democrats that said, why don't we say at a national level, we're not going to have abortions past 20 weeks. You know, most of the polls that have been taken show that majority of Americans could support that, whatever else the states may do with earlier abortions. You know, this gives the pregnant woman a great deal of time to decide whether she wants to carry this pregnancy to term. And we could set that as a floor of sorts, and then states could make their own policies in addition to that. It does not stop a very large percentage of abortions, but at least can we agree that when the child is fully formed, has all the organ systems, and by most accounts could feel pain from the abortion, let's at least have that as a minimum standard and then debate the rest. I think it'll take some changes in our government in the next elections, maybe, to make that a possible thing to pass at a federal level. But there are a lot of opportunities here for saying, what can we agree on? If we're not going to say abortion on demand and without apology for all 9 months, can we agree on anything at all?
This judgment by Justice Samuel Alito was in a case called Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. It's not normally referred to as that. It's just the destruction of Roe v. Wade. You haven't got a crystal ball, but in your judgment, is it going to happen? Is Roe v. Wade going to be overturned? Will we have Dobbs versus Jackson Women's in its place?
I think so. And the wild card here is the Chief Justice himself, Justice Roberts, who did not join the draft opinion. And he's been seen as a kind of a moderate who's very concerned about the legitimacy of the court. Some people are speculating that he might be drawn on as a sixth vote because he's going to tell protesters that he can't be intimidated. Other people are saying he may try to pick off one of the others for a decision that leaves Roe v. Wade standing in some form. And I don't know whether either of those has any truth to it. But I do think that having withstood these protests and this sense of outrage, which eventually people would get tired of, I would think, calm down enough to at least talk to other people, you know, the court might be ready to say, you know, if we're ever going to do this, this is the time. When the shock and outrage is expended, people will actually start reading this opinion and realizing it makes some sense. You know, let us show that our legal arguments and our facts are what they are very difficult to deny, and move on and let democracy work.
That's a very good note to finish. Richard Dürflinger, thank you so much for all you've done on behalf of the preborn, the unborn, the vulnerable, and thank you for joining us on Merely Catholic for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bless you.